Larry Reed.
Thank you, Larry. It's my pleasure to be able to introduce Dr. Miller today. Dr. Miller is a full professor at the University of North Carolina in the Department of Environmental Sciences and Engineering, where he until recently was the chair of the department. Dr. Miller received his PhD from the University of Michigan about 20 years ago. He served as editor of several major journals, including Groundwater, ES&T, and currently editor of the Advances in Water Resources. We're lucky to have him with us today. And the subject of Dr. Miller's discussion today is going to be on enhanced remediation approaches to dealing with dense non-aqueous phase liquids. Dr. Miller?
Yes, thank you very much for that introduction. This is a new format for me, one I look forward to, and it will provide a means for me to reach an audience that I might not normally have reached through my work over the years. What I'm going to talk about today is enhanced remediation of DNAPL systems. And I hope there's something for everyone here. About the first third of the talk will explain to you how we got from some basic research and some observations that we had made both through laboratory experiments and through some numerical modeling come to some conclusions about remediation of contaminated subsurface systems. So this, like many of you, this is a problem that I have been working on for some time. About the next third of the talk, what I want to do is explain to you and show you the results of a variety of laboratory experiments that we have undertaken over the last few years to investigate a new class of remediation methods for what we think is an extremely difficult class of problems, those sites contaminated with dense non-aqueous phase liquids such as chlorinated solvents. In the last third of the talk, what I'll do is relay to you some ongoing work that we have yet to publish in any form, and relate it to some of the current open questions that we have, and try to give you a good picture of where we're going in this continued work. Now, in order to keep us in sync, I'll have to tell you which slide that I'm on, and I'll do that by annotating the number as we move through this. So in the lower right-hand portion of the slideshow, you'll have a number on there, and I'll refer to that number and as we move through it. Now, one other bookkeeping point here is that there is, this is a long slideshow, and this slideshow has more than 80 slides in it, several with movies in them. I am not going to be able to cover all of the details on this, but if in general you will find references to papers that have been published in the literature over in the right and some details about the particular experiments that I may not have time to mention. What I'll do is I'll move at varying rates through this and I'll try to keep us in sync and within the period of about 50 minutes try to get us through this material and hopefully all can learn at least a little bit about what it is that we're doing, if not all of the detail. So let's now move to the second slide, number two. And what I'm going to talk about is depicted here on the slide, this titled Overview. And what I want to do is bring us all up to a common level in terms of how these systems behave, what we know about the physics of them, some experimental and modeling results that show us how these systems behave, and why the behavior of these systems has led to a class of problems that is extraordinarily difficult. I'll then going to tell you a little bit about some of the common remediation approaches And I'll draw some general conclusions about these broad classes of remediation approaches. The ones that I think have no chance of working, or no chance of working in manageable sorts of times, and then I'll target in on some things that I think that we want to achieve if we're going to ever solve this problem of source zone remediation. And I'll then move through and talk in detail about a particular class of method, which I'll refer to as brine-based methods, and we'll look at several variants of that. And not to give the illusion that all the problems are solved, I'm going to be very explicitly list out what some of the problems are that we're still wrestling with and give you some very recent results from our work. Number three. In a certain sense, one can think of multi-phase porous media systems as a grand class of problems of which almost anything in the universe fits. Our goals here are slightly less ambitious than that, but I would still classify multi-phase porous medium systems that exist in the subsurface as among the most difficult problems facing environmental scientists. And this is so because multiple fluids exist in these systems. They occupy a pore space, which has a complex morphology and topology, and the flow of these fluids is complicated. And not only that, it's the medium through which this is occurring is not characterizable or observable in a general sense in the field, although in the laboratory, in many cases, we can go to extremes in order to do so. So given the complexity of this, there are a number of ways that we can think about it. What I'd like you to think about it, for the next few minutes anyway, is that there are a few things that we can extract from such systems, and if we keep these in mind, we can get at least some physical insight into how these systems behave. The first thing I'd like you to think about is I'd like you to think about a set of forces that exist. And I'll refer to these forces as viscous, capillary, and gravity. And viscous forces exist because of fluids in motion that have a viscosity associated with them. Capillary forces exist because of interfacial tension that exists across the boundary between two separate phases and the morphology and the topology of what those interfaces look like. And then, of course, we have gravity forces. Now, these forces interact and are influenced by the properties in the media. And those properties include what that pore space looks like. It includes the fluid and solid properties that affect the contact angles that the fluids would make with, for example, the solid phase, the interfacial tensions, the densities, and the viscosities. And all of these properties are important when considering and studying the behavior of these systems, and consequently, when we try to consider how we're going to go about remediating such a system. Now, together, these things operate to give us extremely complex patterns of flow. And these complex patterns are well understood to anyone who's ever tried to investigate one of these systems in the field, but through looking at some detailed laboratory animations that we have a little bit later, you might get a unique perspective in terms of how these systems actually behave. These systems lead to entrapment of fluid, and that entrapment of fluid happens over time scales that are short compared to the life of an apple. And that life of an apple maybe decades or centuries in some cases. Moving to four, that there are certain characteristics of these systems, and these characteristics are that these residual, these organics that are, when released into the subsurface environment, exist in a state of residual saturation. That is, they become immobile, they become trapped in the pore space, and then one has to figure out some way of either remobilizing them or transferring them to another phase in order to remove them from the system. That the complexities of the flow in these systems is dictated to a large extent by what the properties of the media are and the heterogeneity. And we now know very well from many field studies that have had detailed characterization that field sites are indeed tremendously heterogeneous. And this heterogeneity that exists across a range of scales dictates the behavior of such systems and make them doggedly difficult. We know that L-NAPLs and D-NAPLs behave differently, and that D-NAPLs are especially challenging because they can sink below the water table and making remediation even more difficult. One thing that I'd like to highlight is that we often think of NAPLs in many textbook representations of these would be as residual saturation. And one key point that I would like you to take away from this, and I'll show you evidence that I think may persuade you, is that is if you look at the majority of a D-NAPL in a subsurface system, is that a lot of this is contained in features that are not single or small number of pore spaces, but that they exist over large length scales and are pools, depending upon what one's definition of a pool is. Perhaps not long enough to transmit a pressure gradient over the entire domain of interest, but long compared to a single pore size. And that these NAPLs are very long-lived in the environment, and that's why they're of interest to us. If you move to five, you get a picture of a cartoon, and I'm not going to go through this cartoon in detail, but it's a cross section, so the ground surface is at the top of this, and as you move down, what it shows is the sorts of behavior that one would get as you move through the unsaturated zone to the water table, beneath the water table. And what I'd like to highlight is that it's that heterogeneity that exists in virtually all subsurface natural systems that lead to these large length scale features, which I'm going to demonstrate to you, and the complexities of this flow pattern. And I would say that the complexity of the NAPL distribution and, in general, the heterogeneity of the subsurface is the primary factor that has led to the difficulty associated with the remediation of these systems. Moving on to six, what I want to show here is this is a slide that's titled Micromodel TCE Residual. This is a microscale experiment that was done in our laboratory, and what it shows is it's a thin two-dimensional cell, and again, I'll highlight that a lot of the details are over here on the right, and I may or may not mention each of those, but as you go back and look at this slideshow later, those details will be there for you. What we tried to do in this experiment was we tried to create, artificially, admittedly, as homogeneous of a system as we possibly could. These are all very uniform glass beads, and you might say, well, this doesn't look very much like the natural systems that we're trying to remediate. And that's true enough. But let's go on just the same. The glass beads here are extremely uniform, and what we did is we brought that system to a state of residual saturation. So here and in many other slides, we have dyed the D-NAPL, in this case it's trichloroethylene, red so that we could visualize it. And what you see here is on the top part of this, you see a region that we zoomed in on and captured photographically. And what I want you to see from this is that even in this system that we tried with some effort to make homogeneous, you still have this relatively large, complicated region of residual D-NAPL. And you might say, well, it looks like an O to me, and what significance does that have? The significance that it has is that when you get features like this, the interfacial area between this NAPL and the water that will fill the pore space and flow by it becomes relatively small if you compare that to whether the condition under which that bean apple was contained entirely in, say, single or two pore space regions. So it's these large interconnected regions that that exist even in very, very homogeneous systems. And what I'm going to show you is that this becomes even more pronounced as the degree of heterogeneity increases. The lower pane in this shows the result after an extended period of flushing, and eventually what happens in these systems is that eventually they do break up into smaller regions, and the rate of mass transfer then becomes somewhat faster because the interfacial area has changed. In seventh, what you see is the result of a series of laboratory experiments. This is one of those that we did, and this laboratory experiment was conducted because typically in the field, records of decision and attempted cleanup levels for chlorinated solvents, we were trying to get to drinking water standards, and in fact still are in many cases. And yet we could not find in the literature a single example where anyone had taken a sample that was contaminated with a chlorinated solvent and tried to use a method that would be equivalent to pump and treat to approach this level that we were trying to reach in the field. So this is a one-dimensional system. There's no ability in a one-dimensional system for bypassing to occur as it would in 2 or 3D, at least not to the extent. And what, rather than go through all the details of this, I'd like you to see is just a couple of features. First of all, on the ordinate of this, we show trichloroethylene concentration, which starts out as solubility, and something down approaching drinking water standard, although not quite there. And this is in a log basis. And then across the abscissa, what we show are the number of pore vidants passed through the column. Now, photographically, laid over the top of this, what we show is the distribution of NAPL. And again, this is zeroing in on one particular part in this column. So this is an experiment that was done at a little larger scale than the other one. Still, attempts to work with a natural porous media system, unlike the glass bead system, but still a pretty homogeneous one. And what we saw in this particular case is rather remarkable. And that is, if you look at the top picture, what you'll see is you'll see some NAPL residual, and you'll see one region that is relatively large, and it's toward the lower right portion of that figure. Well, that one large region dominated the behavior in this particular experiment, and it wasn't till that region disappeared that we began to approach low levels of concentrations that one might try to get to in a field-based remediation. And even that, the time scale was on the order of 1,000 pore vidants. Now, in two dimensions or in three dimensions in the field, and with more complex distributions and greater amounts of heterogeneity, I would expect that number of pore vidants would grow dramatically. So I think 1,000 is probably a lower bound. You couldn't imagine a simpler system than this. And again, the takeaway message is, even in simple systems, you get large link scale features with small interfacial areas and significant mass transfer limitations. Going to 8, this is an example from a network model simulation, so there's no data associated with this, but what it is it's a simulation that where we mimic the pore space in terms of pore bodies and pore throats, and then we simulate the physics that goes on at the micro scale. And what we show over on the right-hand side is after this system reaches residual saturation, such as it would after a spill, one can look at what the distribution of NAPL would look like in a system like this. And what you see is a very wide range of pore sizes that the NAPL occupies, all the way from the top where we have singlets. And in fact, if you were just to look at the number of those, you have more singlets than you do anything else. But if you were to look at where the majority of the mass is contained, it's contained in a very few, very large, relatively large, complicated distributions. And so this is, I think, a consistent story. We now have a couple of different laboratory experiments at a range of scales, and we have network simulations that show the same thing, the existence of these complicated patterns, complicated distributions, morphologies of NAPL, which I would contend are extremely difficult to remediate. Moving on to 9, this is just a realization. This is another type of model. It's what's called the percolation model, and it's to give you an idea on a little bit larger scale how we would expect these systems to behave. So across the bottom, this is, again, a cross-section. We're going to move NAPL into this thing from the top, and we're going to watch its distribution as it moves vertically and also horizontally. It's a two-dimensional simulation. And the next several frames, you can kind of click through and do so. So if you look at 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and stopping at 19, what you see through that series of slides is the progression of an apple moving in from the top of the domain as it moves through the system. And what I want you to gather from this is that, first of all, the majority of the domain doesn't have any NAPL at all in it. So if you're out in the field looking for NAPL and you're not finding it, don't be surprised. That's exactly what I'd expect from the physics of the system. This is not an extremely heterogeneous system. The conductivity field is about as uniform as you're ever going to find in the field, but yet it is still significantly sufficiently heterogeneous so that you get this complex flow pattern. So not only do you have the majority of the domain that doesn't have much NAPL in it, but if you look locally over very small scales, what you find is that the saturations can be pretty high. I would say that this is a consistent picture, and consistent certainly with the laboratory experiments and with the network modeling results that I showed. So we have several lines of evidence that point to the same thing, and these lines of evidence point to the fact that the heterogeneity of the subsurface and the pore-scale physics of NAPL systems lead to extremely complex flow patterns, and they lead to regions that have relatively small interfacial areas between the NAPL and the surrounding fluid, which has in this case been water. And that is going to pose a major problem as we try to remediate this with such systems with a variety of common technologies. So if we move on to 20, what I'd like to do in the next series of slides is just to mention a few of the remediation approaches that have been tried under both cases traditional practitioners, but they've also some of these more advanced ones have been tried in field scale trials in our continuing efforts to evolve more efficient ways of remediation. And I'm not going to talk about the details of all of these. All I want to do is highlight what the different classes of remediation methods are, and then I want to draw some general conclusions that I believe hold for the remediation classes that I'll talk about, which is, I would say, the variety the vast majority of cases that we've actually looked at. So the ones that I'm going to talk about include those listed here on slide 20, and as we go to 21, we're all familiar with pump and treat, and we're all familiar with the challenges that has posed. I think it's now well understood what the basis for that is, and maybe some of the detailed results that we've looked at already would give you some insight as to what has went wrong with pump and treat. It's heterogeneity that has led to bypassing. It's also very slow rates of mass transfer that occur because of the distribution of the of NAPLs that exist in such systems. And recall back to that one-dimensional column where we needed something on the order of 1,000 pore volumes, and I said that that was an absolute lower bound. You go to a real system, it's going to be much higher than that, and it's no wonder that the general consensus is now that you're never going to remediate a denapled site with a pump and treat, and the best you can hope for is to control the flow system well enough so that you don't have contaminants moving off site. If we move to 22, vapor extraction is another commonly used class of remediation method and has had some success in some cases. And those cases, I would say, would be cases that would be favorable in terms of the interfacial area that exists between the phase you're trying to remediate, favorable Henry's constant. But of course, the problem that's posed by DNAPLS is that the majority of the mass may exist below the water table. Of course, when that happens, you have to first get the DNAPL to the water table before you can remediate it with any sort of a vapor extraction system, and you have significant mass transfer limitations in doing so. Well, because of that, people have tried air sparging, where they try to inject a gas phase below the water table with the hope of stripping the NAPL up to the surface. And the challenges associated with that include the fact that you have significant gravity forces, and you also have heterogeneity that leads to preferential flow patterns, a relatively small area of influence by these injection wells. And in general, the results have not been very favorable for such technologies. There have been many efforts at cosolvent and surfactant flushing, and these fall into a couple of general categories. First category would be where one tries to affect the balance of forces such that you mobilize the DNAPL, and those were relatively quickly abandoned because when you cut interfacial tension, DNAPLs can become vertically mobile, and you can violate what I was informed by a practitioner as the number one rule of remediation, and that is don't make things any worse than they already are. And so the other class that people have looked at are cases where you affect the solubility, but you don't affect the interfacial tension sufficiently such that you can mobilize the contaminant into uncontaminated portions of the system. And it turns out that that there are mass transfer limitations associated with that, but it also turns out very interestingly that you do affect the aqueous phase density by increasing the solubility, and it turns out you don't have to affect that density very much to start seeing density-motivated flow and complex flow patterns that result from that. So there are mixed results from that as well. Then as well in 25, there are a variety of thermal processes that have been used, again, mobilization can occur in these. It may be difficult to contain them, and these are expensive technologies in terms of energy. On 26, bioremediation has certainly got a lot of press and is an attractive alternative for many classes of contaminants. For DNAPLs, it's less attractive because the rates of degradation are relatively slow, and you still have to get the NAPL out of the NAPL phase and into an aqueous phase before you can react it. So it's that mass transfer limitation that one hasn't avoided. You've lessened it somewhat because you can increase the driving force and therefore the rate of mass transfer, but you still can have significant limitations. So if, on 27 then, if we try to draw some, a summary, some takeaway messages, in general my analysis of current approaches, I think that many of them suffer from mass transfer limitations. And now that we know what the morphology of an apple looks like in the subsurface and why, maybe it's understandable because that mass transfer has to occur through an interfacial area that exists between phases, and flow bypassing can greatly enhance those limitations. Technologies that mobilize NAPLs have to do so in a controlled manner, and most of the ones that we have available to us so far don't necessarily meet that criteria and therefore raise concerns of regulators. Some of the more aggressive technologies are extremely expensive, and and pose problems for that reason alone. In situ removal is difficult, but it's not the sole part of the problem. Once one removes contaminant from the subsurface, you have to have waste streams that you can indeed handle and treat. So I guess, in summary, what I'd like to say is both applies for both the all existing classes of remediation methods that I know about, and including the work that I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk, and that is, I don't think there exists, nor do I see any time in the near future, where we're going to have any technology that's going to be a fix for all DNAPL source zone remediation problems. I had a congressman ask me once, a very frustrated congressman, I might add, saying, well, if we can put a person on the moon, why in the hell can't we remediate a DNAPL site? And my response was, well, remediating a DNAPL site is much more difficult than putting someone on the moon. And he accepted that answer, but I'm not sure that he found it terribly satisfying, but I believe it to be true. If we move on to 28, I think this is my wish list. And if you're going to have an effective remediation scheme, I think you have to remove the source zone, because source zones are so long-lived that if you just go after a plume, you haven't solved the problem. Maybe you shrunk the problem, but you still may be in the game for a century or more on some of the DNAPL sites. I think any sort of a technology that relies upon mass transfer process that is potentially slow, that's most of the ones that we've talked about so far, are doomed to failure. I think what we have seen with pump and treat may be an extreme, but I think you can go right down the list of any other one that relies upon a mass transfer process, and I think you're in the game for a very long time. And that probably will not come as a surprise to the practitioners in the audience who have actually been trying to remediate with a variety of these technologies and are not seeing low levels being achieved, or at least on a sustainable basis. I think we have to avoid technologies that can spread a contaminant, and I think we'd like to accomplish remediation in a relatively short period of time. And I guess our time scale of what we consider a relatively short period of time may vary from individual to individual, but it certainly has been influenced by the results of many trials to remediate these systems over the last quarter century. And finally, I think what you'd like to be left with is you'd like to be left with some sort of a manageable above-ground treatment problem once you're done. Now, I presented this list to a distinguished audience some time ago, and they said, it was about at this point, they said, well, yeah, that's great. We agree with all that, but what are you going to do about it? If we move to 29, let me tell you what I think we can do about it for at least some cases. We have been looking at a class of remediation method, which I'll refer to as density-based remediation methods. And the notion here is that what we want to do is manipulate the physicochemical properties of the fluids that occupy the pore space so that we can accomplish the objectives that I set out in the previous slide. That may seem kind of vague. But in general, what we're going to use is we're going to use brines that are available, have been used widely in the petroleum industry for many years, and food processing and a number of other industries. And these brines have the characteristic that they are denser than the DNAPLs that we're trying to remediate. That density can be used in order to control the mobilization and in some cases, to actually affect the mobilization. So in general, the brines will be used to control the movement of the DNAPLs, and we'll look at a variety of other ways of manipulating forces so that we can remediate these systems. And let's move on to the next slide. Now, we've looked at a variety of approaches, and let me categorize these into three approaches. So let's take the upward displacement, where we try to displace Dean Apple upward, downward displacement, where we try to move Dean Apple downward and capture it off the top of a brine layer. Let me refer to both of those as primary treatment, or an example of a primary step of this class of technologies. Then there is a class of applications of this of these technologies that I'll talk about, where what we'll try to do is we'll try to manipulate further the physicochemical properties of the Dean Apple and the fluids that remain. And for an example would be if we add a surfactant or flush with a surfactant on this. And let me refer to that as secondary treatment. And finally, in some cases, we may follow those steps of treatment with additional steps, and such as vapor extraction. And I'll show you some examples where we string these technologies together. So you can see that that we're going to talk about pretty complicated systems. We're going to talk about systems where we have Dean Apples present, where we have a gas phase present, where we have a water phase present, where we're going to add a brine, where we're going to manipulate the chemistry with surfactants, and then we're going to look at vapor extraction. So these are really complicated systems, but they're pretty interesting too. So let's move ahead. So 31, and I hope that all of you have the animations going. So if you're in the slideshow, you ought to see some movement going on. And the movement is an X-ray device, and that X-ray device outputs a stream of photons, which are attenuated as they move through this column. And this column is a glass bead column that has trichloroethylene dyed red, and it's at residual saturation. And so as you're watching this at a time of just over 1 hour, what you'll see is you'll see a dark region moving in from the bottom. A dark region moving in from the bottom is a dense brine. This was one of the first experiments that we did to see if we could mobilize Dean Apple by the use of these brines. So the purpose of this experiment was to see if a brine could reconnect the Dean Apple, overcome the capillary forces that have it trapped, and move it out of the system. And some of these animations we'll discuss long enough for them to run completely. Some of them, in the interest of time, will cut off, and we won't get all the way through. What you'll see in this particular animation is you'll see the Dean Apple being displaced up, where you'll see the details of this are discussed in a paper that was published in ESNT a few years ago. And in general, we got 65 to 74% removal from a single pore volume flush with one of these dense brines. So that was kind of the first experiment that we did on this. On the next slide, what you're going to see is a two-dimensional animation, and you're going to see a number of them like this. So here's a cross-section of a multi-dimensional system. Dean Apple is added from the top, again, as previously and in the future, I won't mention this again, the Dean Apple is dyed red for visualization purposes. That dye has a small effect on the physicochemical properties, not a large one. I would expect that the Dean Apple would behave much like this if it weren't dyed. In this particular case, it was the analog of what was done in one dimension. What we were trying to do is to see if we added a brine to the system, how much of the Dean Apple could we displace up and out of the system, and how quickly would it happen. And in this particular case, you can see the Dean Apple being conveyed to the top of the system, and more than half of it was removed with a single pore volume flush. Now, this was a little bit less than what we had seen in the previous one-dimensional experiment, and it was simply because there's more complexity in the pore structure. This is a heterogeneous system, and where you see the Dean Apple is in the coarser pore structure, and the lighter portion is the finer, and for capillary reasons of pore scale physics, the Dean Apple is going to tend to stay in the larger pore region of the system. Moving on to 33, this is a next experiment that we did, and in this particular case, there was some significant differences. the significant differences were that we attempted to minimize the amount of brine that was in the system, so we established only a very thin layer of brine on the bottom. And then what we did is we created, we dewatered the top of the system, and the reason we dewatered it was to affect gravity forces and mobilize the NAPL downward. So the idea is drop the water table, changes the balance of forces, mobilizes DNAPL downward, and then further to mobilize that DNAPL by adding a surfactant. And that surfactant mixture that we add, and again the details are available elsewhere, drop the interfacial tension by more than two orders of magnitude and can greatly mobilize the NAPL that's present. Now, if one did that without having a brine that was present, then you could see mobilization of this DNAPL downward and no ability to capture it. In this particular case, what you see is the DNAPL being conveyed out of the system as if collected off the top of the brine layer. And if we let this animation go, you would see separately the surfactant mixture coming through and removing some of the residual DNAPL that's trapped in small pools that are present after the dewatering portion of this alone. But we're going to move on. In 34, you see a liquid saturated case, and this is a downward vertical displacement. And increasingly more realistic patterns of heterogeneity, and again, this is one that is done with a surfactant flush. The patterns that develop are, as I'll note, are heavily dominated by what the heterogeneity is of the system, and this is, again, consistent with what we have seen from a variety of other types of experiments and also from mathematical models used to simulate this system. We understand the pore-scale physics of this, and we understand why we see the complexities in these flow patterns. This is a case where the DNAPL is mobilized down, and again, it is collected off the top of a brine layer. And pretty much all of the results that we'll look at from here on out are for cases where instead of trying to displace the DNAPL upward, what we'll do is we will move it downward and we'll collect it off the top of a brine layer. If we move on to the next one, two-dimensional unsaturated downward vertical displacement, that's 35. What you'll see is some pretty interesting things here. You'll see, first of all, a pretty high rate of removal from a what is a very, very low pore volume flush of surfactant, 0.3 pore volume downward flush. And we're collecting, again, the mobilized contaminant off this brine layer that's established at the bottom of the system. If one allows this animation to run sufficiently far, what you will see is you'll see around a time of 4-5, you'll see the surfactant front move into the system. And as that surfactant front moves in, what you'll see is a very interesting feature. And that is, you'll see, as you would expect, the mobilization of the DNAPL, but you'll also see the removal of the water. So you'll see the tint changing. And that's indicating the extent to which the medium is being dewatered by the addition of the surfactant. Again, it's due to the changes in the interfacial tension. This is a key observation, so keep this picture in mind. And it's this marked change in interfacial area that we're affecting by between the DNAPL and the gas phase that will pay real dividends as we look at ways to remediate these even further. On 36, what you'll see is you'll see a three-dimensional experiment. So as our work has progressed, what we have done is we went from one to two to three-dimensional systems to increasing degrees of heterogeneity. What we're trying to do is get as close to what we think we would see in the field as possible. Now, in these three-dimensional experiments, there's one big difference, and that is you can't follow the trace of the DNAPL down because all you're looking at is one plane through a three-dimensional system. So what you're seeing is on the outside face of this cell where the DNAPL is, but you're not seeing the pattern that it took to get there, which is admittedly very complicated. So we did a number of these experiments. We did them both liquid saturated, and we also did them unsaturated. So if you switch to 37, you'll see an unsaturated version of the same type of three-dimensional experiment. And the results that we got through very small pore volume flushes were pretty encouraging. Two-thirds or so of the DNAPL was removed with very small pore volume flushes. It was at this point that we made the observation in this paper that we published in ESNT that, we've got two-thirds of it out very, very quickly, and by visually observing the state of these systems, we think that getting a significant amount of the remaining mass in there would be relatively easy because of the large interfacial area that exists between the DNAPL and the gas phase. So our speculation, and it certainly was speculation at this point, but it was based upon a lot of observations, was that we could affect much higher rates of removal if we added a tertiary step to this. So if you move on to 38, this details some of the properties of a more complicated three-dimensional system that we investigated, more heterogeneous. We switched to a calcium bromide brine solution, which is readily available and, again, used in the food industry and also in the petroleum industry. If you move to 39, it gives a picture of what the laboratory cell looks like in three dimensions. In 40 is a cartoon showing where we're adding the trichloroethylene to this particular system. We're flushing brine from the corners of this and removing it from the center. 41 shows some sections through this to give you a little bit better what the layout of this particular cell is. And then if you look at 42, this is what the waste stream from this cell looked like. So those first top row of bottles, that's the what I would call the production from the primary stage of this, where we're affecting gravity forces in the system, capturing the DNAPL that is mobilized from the top of the brine layer due to changes in gravity forces. And then what you see in the remainder of those in the green tinted bottles is the secondary production. And that secondary production is due to the addition of a surfactant which cut the interfacial tension, freed up a good bit of the residual, and allowed us to remove a significant amount of the mass. If you look at slide 43, what you see are three replicates. Again, these are all three-dimensional experiments. And you see on the ordinate the percent recovery. So this is the fraction of the DNAPL removed. And this is during primary and secondary removal in these systems. So primary and secondary means we're dropping the water table, we're flushing with a surfactant. So the abscissus shows the effluent or the pore volumes of surfactant that we use to flush this, and you see that we've got something around 80%, and then we sort of tail off. Well, for two of these experiments, what we did is we followed this secondary treatment with tertiary treatment. And in that case, what we did is we did vapor extraction, trying to test the hypothesis that large interfacial area would lead to rapid mass transfer in these systems, and therefore high rates of DNAPL removal. And 44 shows a cartoon of what that looks like. 45 shows a condenser setup that we use to capture the gas stream and quantify the NAPL that came out of it. 46 shows a depiction of what the NAPL left in the system looks like after we did an extraction of it, and the blue case, which seems to stick out from the red and the green, is the case where we did no tertiary treatment at the end of it. If you look at 47, it characterizes how each of these experiments were done. And if you then look at the animation on 48, what you see here is in a nutshell, the chief finding from this. And that is, here's a heterogeneous, three-dimensional system TCE added to it a tertiary removal system, and this was this is the poorer of our two results where we used the tertiary system. We flushed with 3.2 pore volumes of a surfactant solution, and we followed that with a relatively short period of vapor extraction. And the results that we were able to achieve was 99% removal of the TCE. The other experiment that we did of this nature, we got in the neighborhood of 99.5% removal of TCE. And again, this is with a relatively small surfactant flush. Moving on to 49, I don't want to give the impression that that we've solved this problem. That the DNAPL problem is done and y'all need to look for a different line of work, because that's not exactly the case. There are a number of issues that are open, and while of the these results are extremely encouraging, it's not quite time to declare victory yet. So one of the, if we look at what those list of things are that one needs to consider, it's the scale up of these systems. And the complexity of the systems adds to a number of things that have to be considered. Can you get this brine in place, and can you control the density and the recovery of it? The nature of the brine and the DNAPLs lead to complexities related to surfactant selection. There are geochemical questions regarding the stability of these systems and what sort of behavior one might see in the presence of these high concentrations of brine. Then there's waste treatment, separation issues. Of course, we would like to model this, and one of the areas that that my group works in extensively is the development of mathematical models for complex systems. And this particular system poses, because of the physicochemical complexities of it, poses a number of very interesting open questions related to that. And of course, once we have such a tool, we'd like to use that for optimal design. And as I mentioned earlier, this technology and any other technology that I can think of is not going to be well suited to all cases. And so one would like to know, where does it make some sense to apply this technology and where it doesn't. So with this set of open issues, what I'd like to do now for the remaining few minutes that I'm going to talk is I'd like to step through some work that we've done that has yet to be published, but we have been extremely busy and are trying to resolve a number of these issues. And I'll just want to give you kind of an overview, very quick overview, of where we're at with some of these issues and where we're headed. So if we go to 50, what you'll see is an aerial photograph of Dover Air Force Base. And in our efforts to scale up and resolve some of these issues, we have decided to run a field trial of this and are in the preparatory stages for that. We'll begin that field trial within the next couple of weeks. We're now in the process of getting materials on site to do that. 51 shows what the Dover National Test Site looks like. For those of you that are not familiar with it, there are a number of test cells, there's a building for analytical support, and there is also an external portion where jet grout barrier and other things have been examined. If you look at 52, you get the concept of the Dover site. There's a double sheet pile wall that has been constructed and keyed down into an impermeable clay. They have permitting from the state of Delaware to allow the release of up to 100 liters of perchloroethylene. And they have a series of wells that are installed, and they have compared virtually a wide variety of technologies that have been used and are currently being used to remediate such sites. 53 gives you a little bit of idea what the scale of this is and how it's constructed. Moving on to 54, the typical way in which experiments are done out there, TCE is added, it's smeared through the saturated zone, and then the remediation method to be tried is implemented. 55 shows what the sampling looks like at Dover, and it's unlike anything that you're apt to see in practice. It's They can capture 100 samples from multi-level samplers at a given time. And moving on to 56 shows the density of wells. The length scale on this is a couple of meters. 57 gives another view of what this sampling scheme looks like. And on 58, you can see all the hardware that goes down one of these wells, and it's impressive. So there's some significant investment here in developing and instrumenting this site. And again, it's a significant step up from the laboratory. It is a natural field site, but it isn't the hundreds or thousands of meters that one might try to do for a full-scale implementation. It's meant and intended to be a controlled intermediate-scale level of experimentation. 59 just shows a contaminant injection point, 60 multi-level sampler panel as well. The containment area on 61, of course, any of these technologies require you to bring a number of solutions in and store your waste and move them off-site, and they have excellent facilities for that. Moving on through 63, they also have the ability to capture samples from the subsurface as needed. 64 is an interesting slide, and what we've done here is we've characterized the test cell that was used and some details about the technology that was tested and the recovery that was achieved. And what has been observed in these is that there have been varying levels of success with each of these, but none of them have achieved anything approaching complete removal, nor do we expect that will be the case here. The most favorable technology so far from this comparison has been a study that was done by Michigan Tech, John Gerke, in which they did extensive air sparging and soil vapor extraction and were able to get 88% removal. The ongoing bioremediation is the last I saw the data of that. They were in the vicinity of something a little less than 50% removal, and my guess is that mass transfer limitations would prohibit them from getting high rates of removal unless that experiment was run for a really long period of time.
Dr. Miller, let me interrupt you for just a minute. This is Larry Whitson. We're running a little bit long. I want to apologize to the participants. I know that we had only originally scheduled till 3 o'clock. We are going to continue. We hope to get to the question and answer periods within about 10 minutes or so. So if you can hang on, please do. If not, there are email contacts as well as the feedback form on the seminar homepage that will allow you to submit your questions. And also those of you who have submitted questions already, if we do not get to those, we will get you an answer by email. Sorry to interrupt, Dr. Miller. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm on slide 65 right now, and the 10 minutes that Larry suggested, I won't need that much. I intend to move through the rest of these slides in less than 5. And really what I want to do with the remainder of these slides is just give an idea of some of the aspects of the ongoing work that we're doing in order to prepare us for this field study at Dover. And we've done such things as characterized the density of the brine as a function of the mass fraction on 65. And an interesting thing is that these brine solutions are viscous solutions, as you can see on 66. And that viscosity contrast is something that is unfamiliar to most groundwater hydrologists because you never encounter solutions that are this viscous. The characterization of that. Then there are a number of slides starting on 67 for a three-dimensional experiment that we did to mimic the Dover site, where what we looked at was the formation of the brine layer. We want to be sure that we can establish it. We want to know what the time scale is that we can establish it. And because any application of such technology in the field would require that you also end up removing this brine, and you would want to do so for economical reasons, we looked at the removal of it as well. So in 67, 68 just shows that diffusion really has a small effect on dispersing this brine. 69 shows the recovery of brine, but maybe that's better showed on 70 and 71, in particular 71. So 71 shows returning a system that has had brine in it that you would have used for the remediation of such a site to levels approaching TDS that you might want to get to. And to put things in perspective, this is just in the brine layer, which would in most cases would be a few feet thick, not the entire unsaturated zone, but looking at just the brine layer, you would need to get down to a TDS level of 1,000. If I convert the abscissa to pore volumes, you're going to need something less than 10 pore volumes of a water flush in order to do that. We've screened a number of surfactants, which are shown on this table, and if you step through 73, 74, and 75, you see the results of that surfactant flushing in. There are a number of issues that are important here, and adding the dense brines to the solution complicates the selection of a surfactant. What we have found is that we need a mixture of surfactants, of anionic and non-ionic surfactants, to meet the objectives that we set out here. But we have, we believe, a surfactant solution which is stable, which has attractive properties, and which is extremely effective. We've looked at the sorption characteristics of this surfactant mixture to be sure that we're not going to have separation at the Dover site, and that's shown on 76. 77 is an animation showing that the surfactant mixture can mobilize PCE from the Dover materials, and 78 shows the effect of that surfactant on what we anticipate to be the dewatering of the materials at the Dover site. And 79 and 80 show the results of some geochemical experiments where what we have done is to examine the effect of these dense brines on the properties of clays. And what we have found is that the clays are relatively stable in the presence of these brines and that the permeability is decreased in the presence of the brine but does not rebound significantly after those brines are removed. In the presence of the brines, there's some swelling of the clays, which decreases the permeability. And in conclusion on 81, what I'd like to say is that some takeaway messages that standard remediation approaches are influenced by slow mass transfer and or uncontrolled mobilization, and both of those things can pose significant problems. Now, the brine barrier methods that we have looked at have been found to overcome, at least to a certain extent, these limitations. We have got high fractions of removal from, we believe, realistic, three-dimensional, heterogeneous laboratory experiments, and we're, I think, well-positioned for a field-scale pilot test that will begin shortly, and we should have results on early in the new year. It doesn't mean to say that all of the issues are resolved. If you go back to that list of open issues that I gave, there's still enough things to keep me and my research group and many others busy for a while as we try to further develop and to mature this technology. There are a number of students and collaborators listed on slide 82, and what I'd like to note is that these are students, postdocs, and in some cases practitioner colleagues that have worked with us in the development and evolution of these. This list could be greatly expanded if we included those theoreticians and mathematicians and computer scientists working with us on the development of models for these systems. And lastly, I'd like to close with slide 83 and point you to the form that will help us further improve this series. And thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Dr. Miller. That was a great presentation. I'd like to jump as quickly as we can to some question and answers. The phone participants, if you have a question, you can take your phone off mute. If you used *6 to place your phone on mute, press *6 again, and that will take you off mute. And as you get ready, I'd like to remind everyone also that both my contact and Dr. Miller's contacts are listed on the seminar webpage. Please send us any questions that you have remaining after we get through this period. There's also a feedback form that will allow you to send us suggestions and both comments on this seminar and on this DNAPL series of seminars that the SBRP and EPA have sponsored. And also, we're always open for suggestions for additional seminar topics for this risky learning format that we use. With that, I'd like to go to the phone participants. If anyone is on the phone and you have a question for Dr. Miller, go ahead and take your phone off mute. And if you would, give us your name and the name of your organization and go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Trube. I'm with ERM. We're here in the Austin office listening in, a group of three of us. And I wanted to ask if you'd considered any of the limitations or results of in situ chemical reduction on treating DNAPLs?
That's a class of methods that that I didn't talk about. There are several variants of that, and if one talks about, for example, reactive walls as an example, then that is again a technology that I would say in many senses would be similar to pump and treat. It's probably effective for in certain cases for stopping the mobilization, but it does little to actually remove the contaminant that's present in a source zone. If you talk about in situ oxidation methods, then those methods have mass transfer limitations that can apply to them, and they also have effects on the physiochemical properties of the media. So I think that they are another class of method. They're certainly being used. I didn't talk about them, but I would say that they are not the universal solution to the problem either. So I would say that the comments that I made about mass transfer limitations would apply to that class of as well.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I'd like to read a question I have from one of our internet participants, and let me remind those folks that have been listening to the streaming broadcast, you can submit your questions using the question mark button that's at the top of the slides. And they'll come to me and I'll read them out for Dr. Miller. This question is from, I believe, Navid Saleh at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And he asks, when you inject brine, you are changing the geochemistry. The colloidal particles and even micron-sized particles are going to aggregate, and clogging can change the porosity. How do you think this might change the removal of the DNAPL?
Yeah, I mentioned that in the open issues that there are a number of geochemical issues that apply in this particular case. We have looked at a number of these. I can't say that we've looked at them all. We have, of course, you do have clay stability and mobilization issues. You also have the effects on the properties in terms of swelling of clays and the exchange of ions, cations in the system. All I can say is that geochemistry, of course, is going to vary from location to location, and you're going to have to look at it in a site-specific sense. But what we have found for the systems that we have investigated and include some detailed work that we have done for Dover is that neither the mobilization nor the geochemical issues associated with the clays at the Dover site pose any sort of a problem in terms of dramatic effects on hydraulic conductivity or any sort of mobilization issue. But the questioner's comments are right. There is, for certain, geochemical issues that have to be considered. But what I can say is that for the locations that we have looked at so far, these effects have been relatively small.
Okay, great. Let's check back with the phone participants. If you have a question for Dr. Miller, if you could take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and please name your organization.
Dr. Miller, this is Larry Reed of MDB Inc., and I just wanted to follow up with a quick sort of introductory question. You mentioned, your slide showed your Dover site that you've been out working at. You mentioned a field scale pilot test coming up in the next few months. I was just going to check with you with the listeners on the phone. Are you looking for additional sites where you would like to try applying your refinements of the brine barrier methods that people could contact you after today's session?
We expect that we're going to be fully occupied with the Dover experiment from now until roughly the end of March, and if the Dover experiment goes well, we would expect then that we would be at the level where we could begin to apply this to sites in the field. So we would be looking to the Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and others that have sites. There has been some interest expressed here in North Carolina to try this technology. But we've had several people that have approached us about this, but what we have told them is that we want to hold off until we have this intermediate scale experiment done, and if the results of that are promising and look good, then we think we'll be ready to take it to full scale.
Okay, let's take another question from one of our internet participants. This is from Michael Reed, Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection in Springfield. And he asks, do you believe that the brine approach has applicability in remediating DNAPL trapped in bedrock? If so, how do you anticipate controlling the depth of brine placement so as to get the desired effect?
That's a very interesting question, and I think that there are challenging applications. And you can take it as bedrock, or you can take it as a thick, unconsolidated region. I think they could both be lumped into the same category. And that is, I think, the most likely places to apply this technology are in unconfined aquifers that are underlined by low permeability materials. And Dover is an excellent example of this. I think that there are a lot of other examples of this. I think if you would try to apply this technology in fractured media, I think it could work, but I would worry that if the depth of permeable material was very large, I think that one could have some challenges in applying this. As you begin to talk about systems that are extremely heterogeneous and fractured, I think the problems always get more difficult. And so I think there are some fractured cases where this could apply. I think there's a lot of fractured cases where either this technology or any other technology that I'm aware of are probably not going to be effective.
Okay, let's check back with our phone participants. If you have a question, take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization.
This is Jenny Yingling at the Minnesota Department of Health. I was curious whether there are other brines that would be applicable to this. Not knowing much about calcium bromide, I pulled up some websites after the talk was done, and they give some fairly dire warnings about handling this stuff, at least in its salt form. And so I'm just wondering if there are some less hazardous forms of salts that you could use to create the brine.
We haven't. We've worked with a few salts. My sense is that the dire warnings about calcium bromide are probably not all that dire. We believe that we can remove them to relatively low levels. And our results so far would show that. You're constrained by the case that one has to have sufficient density so that you're denser than D-napolin. In this case, that density is fairly high because we're trying to get denser than PCE at the Dover site. So in certain cases where you're talking about D-naples that are not as dense, then you open yourself up to more brines that may be available. But the concerns that you would have about in terms of the calcium bromide would be corrosivity, for example. And of course, you're going to have to get this thing down to some sort of a manageable TDS level. But for sure, that and I showed some results that indicated this. That's not a difficult problem. We can do that pretty easily. So, in terms of the handling, the pumping, and the piping, as I mentioned, these brines are used in the food industry and they're used in the petroleum industry. So, they are. I think they don't pose the health concern that one would normally think of. And if you look at the MSDS, I think that it would confirm that. So I'm not so worried about calcium bromides. And in any event, I think that they would be removed at the end of a remediation step, and they would be removed at sufficiently low levels that they wouldn't pose any significant health risk.
And just as a follow-up, would you anticipate that you would normally have to have some kind of containment wall or barrier system to control these in the downgradient direction, or do you think you could set up a system of just extraction wells around your treatment area?
Jenny, thanks for an excellent question. I meant to mention that during it. Of course, the laboratory studies that we have done so far have all had containment walls. The Dover has sheet piling, so it will have horizontal containment as well. We have done some work where we have looked at the design of injection and withdrawal systems, and it appears to us from the modeling work that we have done that it is possible to apply this technology to cases where you do not have horizontal containment, and that can be done through a series of injection and withdrawal wells to control the distribution of the brine. That's an excellent question. I meant to mention that, and I'm sorry I forgot.
Thanks.
Let's stay with the phone participants. Actually, let me make a couple brief exit announcements here, and then we'll check one last time for additional questions. We've run quite a bit over today. I hope everyone enjoyed the seminar by Dr. Miller. I'd like to thank him for presenting today, and I'd also like to thank the EPA and NIEHS Superfund Basic Research Program for sponsoring this series of seminars. I would remind everyone that there is a form available on the seminar homepage for submitting comments and further feedback, both on today's event and on the D-naples series, and also suggestions for additional topics. Both my contact and Dr. Miller's contacts are also listed on the seminar homepage. If we don't get to your questions, please feel free to send it to one or both of us, and we will answer them by email. I'm going to come back to the phone in just a minute, but I have another question from Navid Saleh at Carnegie Mellon. He says, I agree to the wish list that you have in slide 28. However, you did not mention about use of nano iron as reactive agents. What are the main problems that you see might occur in its success?
I'm not exactly sure what the questioner is referring to. There are a variety of technologies that one could envision where nano iron might be applied. I haven't worked on any of those technologies, and I did comment earlier on for example, the zero valent iron that would be used in walls and what the problems would be with that. As far as delivering it through nanoscale, I haven't looked at that and really don't want to comment on it because I haven't given it any thoughtful consideration.
That's a valid answer. I have another question from Alan Liu, who is also at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. On slide 64, most studies have recovery less than 80%. What's your insight on what we would do with the DINAPLs left over, which would be more difficult to deal with?
The slide 64 that he refers to are the results that were achieved from various studies that have been done at Dover. And these are the technologies that have been tried so far at that site, and also I would say would consist of the majority of those that have actually been applied in the field and are being routinely used. Our expectation is that we will do significantly better than the 88%. So that's the target that we're shooting for. And as a part of that study, I would say that the endpoint that we're interested in is the mass flux that comes out of a source zone. So we will be characterizing the mass flux that exists at the site under its present condition, which in all cases the cell that we'll be looking at has some residual PCE in it, after we further contaminate it, and then when we're done. So hopefully we will bound both the fraction of mass that we were able to remove in our study, but more importantly, I think, we'll bound the effect that the application of this technology has had on the mass flux of contaminant from the source zone. And I think that's the endpoint of most interest.
Okay. I think we should probably put an end on this. I have about 3:25. Let's check with the phone lines one more quick time. If you have a question, please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, we may have exhausted the phone participants. I think this would be a good time to go ahead and end today's event. I appreciate everyone sticking with us since we ran over our time allotment. And I'd like to thank you one more time, Dr. Miller. And if anyone's still with us, I can remind you one last time that our contacts are available and there is a contact form both available on the seminar homepage. Please continue to send us your questions. And with that, I think we'll sign off. Thank you, Dr. Miller.
Thanks, Dr. Miller. My pleasure.